My name is Ben Parker. I work for a company called Codify. And today we're talking about the work that we did with the Department of Education, with Microsoft, and a number of other partners along the way. But this is sort of a revisit on their journey to get them from their existing mail solution onto Office 365 and the roadmap about that. Now, I was scheduled to co-present this with someone from Microsoft. Unfortunately, that didn't happen today, so I'll try and field all the questions I can, but it's a big problem space, and there's a lot of conversations. I'll do what I can, but if you've got questions, feel free to ask them during the presentation, or if there's something I can follow up offline, I'm more than happy to do that as well. So when we're talking about, well, we'll just go through a bit of an agenda first. So I'll give you a bit of an overview as to what it is we're talking about, what email is and what it was for the Department of Education here in Queensland. Then sort of a introduction to why we had to build something around that, why we had to build something to support them going to Office 365, and it comes down to a lot of their requirements around identities and things like that in the cloud. Then we'll sort of go into, well, what is Office 365 and what is it like to work alongside, build an application that works alongside Office 365? What are the things you need to be thinking about? It's not like the old days where it was like a product every 3 years. You got a concept of Evergreen, which we'll talk about pretty heavily. And then we'll go into the way we do work in terms of running the service for the Department of Education here too. So it's a big breadth of conversation. We'll try and get through it all, but yeah, small audience, so let's make it interactive and please ask questions or tell me I'm wrong along the way. Right, so the starting point. So this is 2 years ago. We're talking about, this is the email that all students and all teachers had across the state of Queensland. So they were all pop mailboxes, and I hadn't heard of that in a while. I think generally in IT we all sort of take for granted things like having Exchange and having contact and CalSync and being able to use it on any device anywhere. But that wasn't the case for the Department of Education and all their students and kids. The mailbox was 25 meg, and you can see the no's there. The big thing that came out, and when we were talking to some of the principals in the early pilot schools, was no calendar sharing, and I can only get the email on one device. They were saying, I'd receive it at work, I wouldn't then have it at home. I'd have to fire up the laptop and things like that. So that was some of the problems that they had. The department engaged Microsoft to come up with a strategy about, well, how do we use your products? How do we get that collaborative experience that we use corporately internally, but how do we get that into our schools? I think it was quite a long engagement where it was originally looking at some on-premise versions of Microsoft technologies, but then it came down to a conclusion, well, let's talk about the cloud and let's see what comes out of that. Ultimately, the decision was made that they would go to Office 365. Now, to set the scene, we'll break these numbers down a little bit more, but the current production tenant has over 1 million objects in it. That's a very, very big tenant. You were talking way beyond the concept of what you can really do in terms of through the management console, or even with PowerShell, there's some nuances and difficulties. And that's where we get this problem of complexity. So there's a lot of things. DEET has some very particular, and rightly so, have some very defined and well-known structures in place to prevent or protect those students, the kids that are under 18, obviously, in an environment where there's all this collaboration. So there's this big box of complexity that's sort of sitting over the top of Office 365, and this was one of the initial challenges. So to get around that, we had to use Office 365 and Exchange Online, predominantly, is what we're talking about here today. And then we had to build a custom application in front of that to help them delegate the management of that out to their staff. Because the other problem is, how do you delegate? How do you empower those people in a school sense to make those changes, to manage their school efficiently without being a global admin? You don't want a teacher or a principal in one school being able to affect, the list of domains or the federation type for their accounts and users. So we had to build a management portal that sits in front of Office 365 that allows them to do the day-to-day tasks in line with some departmental rules. And we'll talk about it more. So when we talk about CSP, CSP is the product that we built that sits in front of Exchange. There's these three core pillars. Each pillar sort of has I'll break it down into what each of those are, but I guess in terms of, you know, Office 365 was the starting piece. It was the token to get to the cloud for Deep, and Cloud Service Broker was there to provision that. The long-term vision is that this will pick up other applications and other cloud services for the department and be used as almost a funnel and a gateway for those applications. So to go through each of these pillars, so identity in Deep is very strong, and it's not It outstrips anything that you'd see out of AD Connect or DirSync or anything like that. You know, they've got specific information about, you know, what role, what school, what year level if you're a student, all exist within for an individual identity, all 700,000 of them. So we wanted to leverage all that information because that's good business context for us. It helps us inform, you know, what decisions and what constraints in a school exist and how do we map the relationships between kids and teachers and principals and other staff at a school. So we had to work with that. We then have the cloud service or the cloud broker pipeline. That's really the provisioning engine. Think of that as your business rule engine. So we know that we need to assign certain licenses depending on your role. We've got that information because we've got identities, but we know that for students, they're going to get Exchange, but they're probably not going to get Link and things like that. Group membership as well, that's a big one. Synchronizing to make sure that at a school doesn't need to provision a staff group and then a year one, two, three, etc. They're all out of the box. They're all seen as standard groups within a school. So we provision those at the time we create a school in Office 365 and we make sure that we put people into those groups. We also then have to make sure that when end of year comes around, we move people through those groups. So we're doing a lot of work and it's always doing something, CSP, we know that. Address book policies, if there's anyone who knows anything about Exchange in any detail, to be honest, I didn't when I started. I had no idea what an address book policy was, but now I know a lot more about them. Address book policies are the container that you would see, which we used in this scenario, but you would also see in mergers or sort of where you've got an ethical wall between two parts of a business. They'd use address book policies to limit the GAL. So instead of being able to search for Smith and seeing all the Smiths within the tenant, which a lot of people obviously do want, if you want to restrict that to see, I only want to see Smiths that are in a school or a department, that's where address books come in. So we'll talk about the work we use with those as well. There's an awful lot of complexity in obviously that, and the requirements from DEET are very specific, which was excellent because they have what they call the duty of care matrix, and that allows you just to look up in a grid view and say, you know, for example, a teacher in one school can see teachers statewide, but they're not allowed to see kids outside their current school where they're working. And then after that, the final pill there is the delegated admin portal. That's where, you know, the day-to-day where teachers and students and, you know, administrators of a school, they go to do activities inside the portal. So that list of web pages is if you want to create a shared mailbox, if you wanted to create a shared mailbox in a school out of Office 365 using the portal, that's the number of things you've got to do. And that's to enforce not just creating the shared mailbox, that's also enforcing all the business rules and sending those ABPs, making sure that we've got the right aliases and the right, you know, sharing protocols on all those. That's how many steps it is, right? And obviously, you've got to be a global admin to get that started and do that work. Cloud Service Broker with the delegated management portal gives them that. They've got the homepage, and click as soon as they're in their school, they can click New Shared Mailbox, fill it out, click Create, and away it goes. That achieves the same thing. So that's what we. So the one on the right there is what we've given out to all the students to say, or all the teachers at the school say, here, use the platform as you otherwise would. Create yourself a shared mailbox for the FATE. Create yourself a group for the Christmas party or whatever it happens to be. But that's the simplification that we've done to be able to empower all those users rather than sort of centralizing it to a select few. So I think that gives a good overview of what it is. The building it stage is probably one of the longer sections of the presentation. It sort of covers off the way we engaged or what, the way Microsoft engaged with partners. Myself from Codify was one of those, and then working with the department. I mean, in terms of the project team, the project team that we're talking about today was about 30 people. It was quite large, and that was, you know, from the department, from Microsoft, from us at Codify, as well as other partners that may be in the room. I think Redify, KJ Ross, they were also around as well. But the flip side to this is there was a lot more activity happening around the surface. There was a whole program of work around migration, around, you know, the internal network structures and approvals and processes and legal sign-off to get the department to Office 365. So this, we're talking here about the project itself in terms of the application we've built. So the way Microsoft Services approach this type of work is they have a department or within services called the Solution Development Center, and that focuses on tackling big problems for organizations that require custom development. So their typical roadmap for doing any work is agile. It's an agile but, I think I've heard a lot of people say most recently. It's agile, but we make it suit the customer. We appreciate that the customer have certain things that they want to be done, whether that be change management or change control, things like that. So we work with that. But generally speaking, the way we approach these things is through an initial iteration, which is just getting ready, getting the team together, building some dynamics and getting some core infrastructure up and running, making sure we've got Office 365 in the background and all those Azure subscriptions we need. Iterations 1 through 3, that's where we're sort of looking at building those vertical spikes to say, this is the complex parts of the system, this is how we're going to make sure we know we can address those up front. And by the end of that third iteration, there's two things. The first one is there's something that's demonstrable. So I can take it, I can deploy it, and it'll do something. That's a big thing because, you know, at that point, in terms of IT projects in general, you've got a stake in the ground to say, no, there's a solution on customer site that doesn't do everything, but it does everything in a way that we know we can do repeatable work to show the next piece. So we might have done groups, but we know we can now do shared mailboxes. We'll follow the same architectural pattern. The other thing it does is it means we've got a very good idea of how much work we've got left. So we know that along the way, we spent this amount of time and we've got these things done. We've also identified some technical debt along the way. Maybe we wanted to rework something that we otherwise, you know, maybe there was a new feature in Azure coming, we want to leverage that, but that's all consumed. But we should have an estimate of where we're going to finish, which then drives, well, what are you going to do in iteration 4 through whenever? So at that point, that's where we're doing, you know, we're building up the team, we've got the momentum, now we're actually just smashing out user stories, we're getting them done, we're pushing them through to the customer back over to the department, and they're able to test it, they're able to see it, and they're able to touch it in their own environments as well. Stabilization and production transition. So these are two concepts that I think are paramount in terms of making sure that a solution gets successfully deployed for a customer. I mean, in this case, we're talking about Evergreen and the way an application sits on Office 365, but to do that, you've always got to be changing. But the first step is making sure that it's successfully deployed and everyone understands. I think we'll talk about it a bit later in the deck, but I think along the way, during the development process, you focus on functional user stories. Those non-functional requirements and operational things generally get pushed down the bottom because your development team, you're working very closely with the business, you're not defining, you know, what operationally, how do I go and check something or something like that. But we'll talk about that in a minute. So this is a diagram of the, or sort of three pictures, I guess. The top one there, the team, is probably important because in the way Microsoft run these projects, and as a partner, I can not say this enough, that it's very inclusive. You know, it's not a hierarchy. It's all, you know, everyone's a peer and everyone's able to voice their own opinion, and that sort of builds a really good collaborative spirit within a project team, and everyone feels that they can help on out, whether you're a developer and you need to help with some, you know, release management stuff or whether you're going to do some testing, you know, everyone's a peer in that sense. the timeline there, that sort of illustrates, I guess, probably the project that we were talking about itself. So, you know, 12 iterations, the final one being the handover there. But, you know, 2-week iterations, and that's quite fast and quite punchy. You know, those 2 weeks break down into a couple of days planning up front. So we sort of look through the list of slated user stories or features we're going to tackle. And then, you know, get to it really. So 7 days of development and then a couple of days of stabilization before review and handover to the customer environment. And the final picture there is really about how we use, well, the tools that we use along the way. So we're using, in the case of the project, we were using TFS 2013, that's now migrated to VSO, but we're using the Agile template out of there to take the business through from their Word documents, which were the high-level requirements, right through to user stories and technical features and things like that, right through to development where they get broken down into tasks, testing where they test those work, but then the whole way through we've got that feedback coming back in, coming the other way, going back to the business saying, hey, well, we've built it this way, this is how we interpreted it, are we right, are we wrong, you tell us, let's work through it together. There's in development teams, I think it's easy to become siloed in terms of, yep, I have my understanding of what I need to do, I'm going to go away and I'm going to build that and come back and it's done. I think feedback's a very important thing, and TFS and Visual Studio Online allow us to keep it all in one place. We invite, the department was in there every day alongside us editing those user stories, they were in there with triage, they were able to make the changes that they wanted to see early on in the piece. Now, I said we'd talk about the scale and the size, so this breaks down what's currently in the tenant. So, I said 1 million objects, 700,000 accounts. There's students, there's teachers, there's the gardeners, there's everyone has an email account across the Department of Education Queensland. There's 200,000 groups. A significant portion of those are ones that are templated for the school, and that whether they be the year level groups or the staff groups, but they also have the ability through the portal to create their own. So they can create their own Christmas group or whatever it is, and they're all as part of that. The other 100,000 are mixed between contact objects, whether they be, you know, contacts that have to exist in the tenant to allow communication, but there's a significant majority of also shared and resource mailboxes, which are new things to the department, and we're seeing a good growth of those as they, you know, leverage those technologies in Office 365. But to do all that work, like how do you create all those things? Well, we have, so it's about 15 months now, but when I put this slide together, it was about 12 months. In the first 12 months, when we went to production, we executed 22 million events. Now, think of an event, if there's any administrators here, think of an event as like when you're in PowerShell or when you're working with Exchange, you're always doing the same thing, and that's, we call it an event, but you're always looking for an object, you're getting an object first. Then you're probably going to make a change to that object, and then you're probably going to check it again to make sure it's stuck or that the object is now how you expect it to look. So we call that an event in CSB. So 3 commandlets per event, 66 million commandlets executed across a 12-month period. That's a lot of PowerShell, nothing that I would undertake myself. The 44 million emails per month, we've recently worked out of a coexistence phase with the incumbent mail platform, and now we're seeing all the email move over to Office 365, and that's just going to grow. So we don't use the console. We don't ever look at Exchange Online console or the Office 365 console. It's just not usable at that scale. So we use all the APIs, whether that be for Azure AD, which is where we do our initial user provisioning and any licensing. Exchange Online, we've got PowerShell through remoting. Link, we've got PowerShell 2, but it's a little bit of commandlets, then remoting. You have to have the software installed, and then it establishes a remoting connection from there. And SharePoint, you get a REST API. They're all different. They're all different mechanisms for getting into each of those platforms. The department's also on a multi-tenant Office 365 platform. So, you know, your tenants out there as well could be on the same servers in the back end. So when you're doing that, it's fair to say you've got to be a good citizen. I can't just go and get all 1 million objects and expect that to work without impacting someone else's Office 365 tenant. So as a result, Microsoft put some throttling in there so you to prevent you from doing that. So this is an early screenshot. I think you can see there it's from May somewhere. Yeah, it's from May. But if you look at it, it's us getting told to please come back later. Don't stop asking me to do some work. You're in a lot of trouble. So the way the policy works, and we've spent a lot of time with the product team trying to understand this and work with it, because a lockout is a bad scenario, but you initially get warnings. You're told, okay, you're probably asking me too frequently. I'm going to put a little micro delay in there, but I'm also going to throw a verbose error out onto the PowerShell line. You then get backed off, so then they start enforcing those delays along the way. And eventually, if you're still not listening and if you're still hitting them as hard as you possibly can, we've done that, we're sorry, you get locked out. So the bottom line there on those three slides is, you know, we were locked out for, you know, 2, 4, and then 5. We got an account locked out for 47 years once. That was when we were trying to do some load testing. It wasn't a significantly good day, but we did raise a very apologetic service call back to the product group to fix that for us. So we have to play nice, is what we worked out along the way. Well, we knew we had to, but it showed us we had to as well. So if we're going to execute 66 million PowerShell commandlets, how do we do that? Well, we've got to scale out with more accounts. So we have to be able to queue work in a way that I can pass some to a worker over here, and I can pass some to a worker over there. They're not going to trip over each other, and we're going to get all that work done. We also need to be able to understand how close to the wire we're running so we don't get locked out. There's a number of different ways, but for something like a lot of the REST services, you get HTTP standard error responses, and it's pretty easy. They give you a message as part of that, but you've got to be able to interpret that for each of those products. With the PowerShell stuff, and this is predominantly with the Exchange stuff, we worked with the product group to understand what it is, the mechanism, how do they work out we're locked out? And then we built our own. You know, it's very easy for me as a human to sit there and go, oh, well, PowerShell console's telling me that I'm doing too much, I'll stop. But when you've got so many of them and you're trying to execute so many events, you've got to then train a computer to do that. It's not easy to achieve. So we mimicked or built a replica of the throttling policies that they have in Exchange Online into our application so we could track it ourselves. We also put a metric in there, so for each commandlet we know a cost. So for me to do a get, it's quite cheap. To do a set, it's a little bit more. But to do something destructive is, you know, significant penalty in doing that in terms of the overall throttling cost. So we built all that in there as well. We also know that it never works all the time. You will always get problems. Now, very wide and ranging. Some of them might be network related. Your PowerShell session's been dropped off, or you may not have done anything overnight, or there may have been some reason one PowerShell session wasn't being used and it's timed out. So we have to be able to recover from the sessions broken. But also we know that there's replication in the back end in the way that AD works as well. So if I talk to an account over here on one PowerShell worker, there's nothing to say it's replicated over there. So I've got to be able to deal with the object, one server telling me the object doesn't exist versus the other servers telling me, yeah, no, it's there, what are you talking about? So we had to build a logic that was idempotent in that we could always do something and do it repeatedly until we got the outcome we wanted. And then it'd still fail again. So these are some graphs that we took for account provisioning. Account provisioning is one of the more significant pieces of work that run through CSB because it's, you know, we're touching all parts of the system. We're using graph, we're using the licensing stuff, and then we're actually going to Exchange Online and pushing those business rules in terms of parameters onto each of those accounts, and we're also setting up the groups and things like that. In general, there's about 40 parameters that get set on an account. That's averaged out between the various types of accounts, but there's about 40 odd things that we do to an account to provision it. So these graphs, the top one there isn't a great one because it's not very linear. And what each of those arrows represent is likely me or one of the other guys in the back end going and trying to understand what's broken and why we're throttled, as you saw a couple of slides ago. So you get slowed right down. So we were provisioning nearly 4,000 accounts in 18 hours. That's not going to scale, and it's not achievable because you just keep getting locked out, and that's where you're going to have to be apologetic to the product group and get them to unlock your account. So using our sort of minimal viable product approach, which is familiar to those of you who have done agile projects before, is like, well, okay, well, we can provision accounts, that's great. Now let's see if we can improve that. How do we get it so that line starts to look linear? How do we make it so that I can know that I can reliably create accounts, in this case, consistently at a consistent velocity? That's what we wanted. The other slide was also probably not a great... Sorry, I'll go back. So that's one session, but so 3,400 in 8 hours is what we achieved, and that's a much more linear line, but you'll also agree that's not going to be scalable when you're going to provision 1 million objects or when you're going to try and manage those over the coming years. So the answer for that is then scaling out. How do I take what I now have working great on this server over here, and how do I make it work over here and over here, all the way down the end of the line? How do I make it so that I can have 100 sessions or whatever? Yep. Yeah, so the reason we use PowerShell it's the API for Office 365, for Exchange Online anyway. There's no other...
Is the only one available at the time that you were doing that?
Yeah, so as I understand, there's changes in that always, but Office 365 gives you it's the only way to set the parameters that we needed to set in Exchange, like not necessarily the group membership. You can do a lot of that stuff in Graph, but setting things like an address book policy, the only way to do that programmatically is via PowerShell through that remoting method. Hence the problem. So from there, we're like, okay, well, how do we scale that out? How do we make it work a lot faster and a lot quicker? So the top line there is very reminiscent of the other slides. It's, you know, a nice linear graph with 1,000 accounts taking about 8 hours. The final part, all the way down this end on that bottom graph, is us doing the same 1,000 accounts just in 30 minutes. So that's how we were able to grab all those workers, have them work in sync, and provision accounts at a much higher velocity for us. Given I've been here for the other slide where I said we've been doing this for a year, I think you probably understand that we managed to get all those accounts in there. But the important thing is where that arrow is pointing. So this is the long running tail of us moving to production. Now with every project, there's a lot of other work. Yep.
Were these accounts created in batches or just accounts per transaction?
So in these slides, that's individual accounts, and they were loaded in bulk. So we'd use a sample size of data and just push those through. This slide here is where we were provisioning all the production users. So that's the identities feeding in from the department into Office 365 as they're being provisioned. Now, the reason there's so many gaps and jumps around there is that we're, as with any project, you're busy going through sort of a soft go live, you're doing some initial user provisioning, you've got to get your sign-offs and your go live documentation all done. The long spike there that goes for 6 days, we did 300,000 accounts and we got that nice linear line before we started doing some migrations and understanding how Office 365 and the mail system that is an incumbent was able to work side by side. And then we got the final few 100,000 done as well. But all in all, we were very happy to see that we were able to achieve that for that extended period of time. Along the way, we'd also see other things as well, like, you know, if you drill down onto that into a hourly or daily basis, we were able to see things, you know, that otherwise, I guess, the back-end teams in the product group were able to see, like, I know that in the production tenant that I can do more work after hours. I think everyone goes to bed in Australia and then all of a sudden there's a little bit more leverage for me to do some work. I can batch up more requests. I'm able to do, you know, we've seen up to about 20 to 25% more work after hours off the East Coast Australia time. And at 3 a.m., I think we've noticed that that's when they do a significant round of sort of internal maintenance time window. And we were able to talk to the product group and confirm all that stuff as well, but it's just interesting that you can sort of see from the other side, from the other side of the Iron Curtain, you're able to see the impacts that you're having, and working with the product group, you're able to say, well, I can see that you're now, you know, now 3 a.m. is not a good time for me to do things because you're busy restarting my sessions over here along the way. So that sort of covers off everything about how we, what we built on sort of some of the scale problems, but the next piece really talks about Office 365 and what it is to build an application that sits alongside it and why it's a bit different to, you know, a typical project that sort of delivers something along the way. So this type of thing shouldn't be uncommon to everyone, but, you know, in the on-premise world and particularly in the product world, a lot of the way you have these massive releases, these three-year releases, whether it be SharePoint or Exchange, that come along, and you've got to first off make the decision to do that work, and then you're going to spin up a project group to provision servers, move people to those, there's migration activity, and then also you've got to let your new users know about new functionality, how it's changed or how or what's different, whether there's anything they critically need that's been changed or not. It gets a little bit worse if you decide, well, I'm not even going to do that one because I don't see there being significant value. I'm still in a supported product sense. But if you skip an update, then you're like, oh, it's a big jump, right? Now I need to push a significant impact onto my end users, and I also need to spin up a larger project team to handle that migration. So the idea of Office 365 is evergreen. So Office 365 is always changing. Now, I'm not just talking about bugs that go into the platform and that are identified by, you know, customers here or globally that then get rolled into the tenant. That happens. But I'm talking about new features that appear in the tenant that enable functionality. Office Mix, Delve, all these things are evergreen. They're always things that come into the platform that your users may want to use, they may not want to, and how do you work with that? So with Office 365 for the Department of Education, it's like, well, they've got some very strict guidance in that duty of care matrix about what people are allowed to see and what people are allowed to do. So that's one lens that we use to view things. But they've also got, you know, people out there that are seeing this stuff. Like they might have Office 365 personal at home. They may have, you know, they've got a husband or a wife or, you know, siblings or whatever that have got, that are in the corporate world, and they've got these great new tools that are in Office 365. So we have to understand how to roll these out and how to stage them into, you know, the school frame. And there's a larger piece of work that sort of is covered off as part of the ongoing engagement we have with the department, which is to help them go through that list. So there's a number of ways you can understand what's happening in your tenant. There's a lot of blogs and things like that. Microsoft has the Department of Education under an NDA where they're able to get some more information earlier. Now, as part of that, they can then look at the roadmap and go, right, well, I can see there's 7 things along the next quarter that I'm interested in seeing in the tenant. There's 5 things that I need to investigate more. I can go back to a product group and understand what's the impact of that, and, you know, is there anything that, any reason that would, any of those products would break that duty of care matrix? Because that's the number one go-to thing that we need to protect. So how do you do all that work along the way? And I guess this sort of illustrates how Microsoft roll out those features across the tenant. So in Ring Zero, that's the actual product, the product group or the feature team within the product group itself devving and eating their own dog food. Once they're at a stage where they've built something, they've released it, they release it to themselves, and then Ring One as well, which is the Office 365 broader product group. So that's where they're taking their feature to the product group, and that might be Mix or whatever it is, and the whole Office 365 team are using it. After that, it progresses along to the second one, which is all of the Microsoft, all Microsoft staff then get to use it in their own Office 365 tenant, so they're able to play with it and understand it. Ring 3 is where it becomes available for general use across Office 365, if you've got first release enabled. First release is a tenant option that you set in Office 365, and it allows you to see those features that are coming through in an evergreen pattern in that tenant first, to get an understanding, to play with it, etc. If you haven't turned it on, it's something that you should. Turn it on in one of your non-production or a test or a mirror of production to understand how those work, how those new features coming down the line can work. And then finally, it goes to Ring 4, and that's everywhere. It's all done. It's deployed globally. So that's how Office 365 works, and I touched on how deep sort of working in an evergreen pattern around reviewing each of those changes. But we need to be able to react to them. If there is a product that's coming, if there's a feature that's coming that's going to stop someone or allow someone to share across schools or see children in another school, things like that, we need to be able to stop it, and that's where Cloud Service Broker comes in. It's always changing. We're always making changes to the product and platform to be able to support that. So I've given this slide a few times, and it always comes up with a different reaction, but we'll go through it anyway. So I think this is pretty typical of the way you see software development projects run in a legacy sense. You see someone in a project world or development, doesn't matter who it is, and they throw something off to our operations, and then basically the business see that. And I think we all get beaten up over that from time to time, and IT sometimes gets a bad name for that. So this is the roadmap that I guess we've done with Office 365. That green looks a bit better there. So in terms of the release, significant releases we've had, they're illustrated there. So the solution development, 0.0, the pilot and the migration piece, and then 1.2 is this run and evergreen state that we're in. Now, when we're doing things, when we're packaging up releases and pushing them over the line into production, there's always sort of three core categories of deliverables that we're doing in each, or three groups of changes that we're pushing across over the line. There's business requested features, so that, you know, that's changes in the way the product works, or, you know, hey, it'd be really good if I could add an alias to a group or something like that. That's a new feature, the business has asked for it, we put it into the product. Evergreen train, which is how we respond to those evergreen changes that are going to land in the tenant. So that's like, okay, well, let's turn off Office Sway or Office Mix. Let's make sure we can't use that, and we then go and scale that out across 700,000 accounts. There's the framework lifecycle piece, which is making CSB a good and healthy application. So I like the analogy of watering a plant. You know, if you don't water the plant eventually dies. And with any piece of software, and particularly with CSB, we rely on a lot of frameworks and a lot of dependencies across technology, and whether that be sort of AngularJS, which is what the website's built in, we want to make sure we're doing those updates. If it's all hosted in Azure, so we make sure that we keep up to the date with the latest Azure SDKs. They give us benefits operationally and efficiencies as well. I think when we started doing a lot of the development, we were on Azure SDK 2.1, and our deployment packages were by what they are today, they were easily 10x. They were a couple hundred meg, and pushing those up all the time into Azure was, you know, a time constraint. So, but now we've gone to the latest SDK, and we get much smaller packages. We can deploy them much quicker, and the logging has improved incredibly. So we are able to see improvements and efficiencies operationally just by doing those changes as well. But how do we make it so that everything can work harmoniously? We're working with the business on one side. Operationally, we're dealing with that as another problem. How do we make everything go? And this is where DevOps comes in. This is the way that we're working as a service provider to make sure that Office 365, the application CSB, are all working together, and we're able to deliver to business and our development team and our operations team as well. I hear DevOps means a lot of things to a lot of different people. I like this slide because I think it's all those things and more. But I've always done a full to release management role, and I always find it's easy for people to say, oh, yeah, DevOps is release management. I don't think it is. I think this is how we're describing it to the Department of Education, how we're talking to them about what DevOps means and why it's important. So for each of the roles or lenses within the organization, business development operations, there's always different relationships. Typically they're quite separate in some cases, but you know, in terms of the way when we start looking at the work we did in the development sense, it's like, well, in development, when we're doing the development and the solution development, we had a great relationship between the business team and the development team. They're always working together, you're always in TFS, we're always in triage meetings, we're always talking to each other to see what's happening in the project, what's happening. But operationally, we didn't do a lot of work in terms of building an application that we would then be able to support. I'm not saying it wasn't supportable, but I'm saying a lot of the tech debt that were things that would make that a little bit easier were pushed down the bottom because they weren't a focus for the business. This is the way we're moving to. This is where we're bringing operations and business and the development people together, and DevOps is the intersection of all of those. It's the people, processes, and products that you use to make it so that everyone's aware and everyone's, you know, able to give their feedback in a constructive way that pushes the product along and defines its future. I think it's also safe to say that a lot of organizations align to a ITIL methodology, and I think I've had a lot of conversations in the past where, well, hang on, I'm not DevOps, I want to be ITIL. ITIL V2, which I think is probably the one that most people are familiar with, I'm most certainly one of those people, is, you know, that very rigid structured around how you move through each of those problem spaces, incidents, services, problems, change, release management. But there's also ITIL V3, which talks about a service lifecycle. It talks about how applications and services are one. There's not a single individual component to each. It's a cyclical movement, and we all need to work together to get it to work. How that moves into the two overlapped is like this. So the outermost circle there is the ever-going process of making changes in an environment. You've got requirements coming in, they go through development, they're pushed to production. The development piece in the middle, the DevOps, which is those three lenses, the three people in the middle, ops, dev, and business, they're there collaborating together. They're at each point, we're making sure that the operations team know what's coming. They're maybe doing the deployment or they're involved. And also we've got the opposite way. We've got the developers involved in production incident issue identification. So instead of just going to a help desk and picking up and talking to an operation person, there's also a developer there that understands that as well. So there is a very tight collaboration. The whole time, it's always changing. It's always continuous improvement. We don't just plan something, dev it, test it, release it, and then it's over the fence, off we go. If you do that, you never know how to improve the operational outcomes because there's no feedback going back the other way. So we have our developers sit there and help with the deployments at production time, go live time. They're sitting there, they're understanding what the nuances are. And it's like, oh, you've got to run all these scripts, or what happens if you run them in the wrong order? All these conversations, it's like, well, wouldn't it be great if we didn't have to do that? How do we improve it for the operational side of the equation as well? So it's that collaboration between those three lenses that make the good outcomes that we've got at the moment. We're still using the same set of tools. We moved from TFS on-prem 2013, we moved to VSO, and we're still using VSO to do all those work items. We've got the stuff on this end, which is those three groups of changes, that whether they be something that the business requests, those evergreen changes, or those framework and lifecycle things. But then we're moving to Visual Studio Online. The logo hasn't come out great there, but that's all right. And we're using work items, we're using integration builds, we're using test automation, and we're able to produce the end-to-end lifecycle of what's happened in a release in terms of a document to say, these are the changes, here's how we've tested it, here's how you're going to go and deploy it, all out of that one source, one repository. The next thing I guess we'll probably shift to talk about is, I guess probably more the operational aspect. How do we look after a tenant with a million objects in it? How do we make sure it's in a working state? We've learnt a lot from the Office 365 product group themselves, and there's some good sessions there as well, in terms of ones that were done in Chicago for Ignite. The top one there is, that screenshot is from the top one there, and some of those other slides that I showed earlier, they're from the second presentation there as well. But I think the key thing that we do, what we try to achieve, is we don't try to achieve 100% green lights. We're not checking every aspect of the solution and every aspect of Office 365. And we don't jump if all of a sudden it goes amber or red or there's an alert. We have to understand generally what is the behavior to those end clients. So this screenshot is an interesting one, because it's actually taken from the office, from that top session there. That is a slide from their presentation where it talks about how they monitor Office 365. They don't sit there and make sure there's no errors in the event log, right? That's a never-ending battle. There are always things in the event log. What they do is they look at the rhythm of the event log. So of all the servers in Office 365, get all those events streamed into a machine learning algorithm, which is what they've got there, but plot it out. It's like, so in normal day-to-day operation, they know they've got errors, and that's okay. But they know that the range of errors is like this. And they know that if something was to go above the threshold or close to the top there, they know they've got a problem, they can react at that point. One of the other things that we've taken a lot of that, and we learn in the same way, we talk about synthetic transactions. So if we have a series of transactions that run through CSB in Office 365 to test the end-to-end scenario. So we know, we might have had a group that wasn't updated for whatever reason, but the synthetic transaction is still working. So the core components of the solution are still there. So there's probably a problem with that group. We can investigate an individual group rather than investigating all groups in the tenant. Gives us that insight as well. So this is one of the screenshots of the nice big 100-inch TV that we've got in the operations room at Microsoft, where we're doing all this work, and that's where we've tried to achieve the same there. I've taken it from a bit far back, but you can see that we've got the graphs. We can see each of the levels, each of the core components that we care about. We can see what they're doing in terms of just a simple line. We can understand. If there's a dip in one, we should see a dip across. If there's a peak in one, we should see them across all of them, because they're all intertwined. There's a relationship between each of those. We don't have a massive long list of sensors or alerts or anything like that. We've just got traffic lights. Traffic lights are a great way to just show, is everything good or is everything bad? We just monitor the core pieces along the puzzle and make sure that they're up and running and sustainable. We also see when we do get a problem along the way, and whether it be a bug or whether it be an operational issue, we're able to add to this quite easily. One of the things that we did with this monitoring solution is we started just turning on SMSs. It's really easy to stop ignoring SMSs. But if you start, and this came from that same session at the Chicago Ignite from the other pages, if you start sending those messages at 3 a.m. as a reminder and a follow-up, people really quickly fix the problem and or work out whether it's a real issue or not and take it off the list. So I'm not saying you need to wake up your operations or your development. What I am saying is you need to wake up operations and development, not just your operational team, to fix those issues to make sure it lands in the next build. So at the end of all that, I guess, we made it to Office 365, and this is back to the original slide where we sort of talked about what the department had when they started with with their incumbent solution. They had the POP3 mailbox. They've now got Office 365. They've got a significantly larger mailbox, as you can see there, but they've got all those other features as well. They've got the calendar sharing, the resource sharing, etc. as well. It was in a meeting we had, a pre-pilot meeting with the principal at a school, and he's like, the best thing for me out of Office 365 will be when my secretary and my administration ladies in the office can see my calendar and stop sending me invites to things when I've already got other work on. So there, it's been a long journey, and it's been quite interesting along the way, and we've done a lot of work, but you know, I think it's interesting to keep getting those, that feedback back from the business to say, you know, these are the changes you've affected along the way. So that covers off my session. Thanks for coming. If there are any questions you want to ask one-on-one, I'll happily wait and talk down the front, or if there's anything now, quite happy to field those. Hey, Chris? Of course it is. Yeah, I do. So I think you're about to kick off some EMS stuff in the next week with Andres. So that, I think we're going to be alongside in some of that to talk about, or how do we use Office 365. We've got obviously all the school identities at the moment. I know that the corp identities aren't included in that, but how they fit in there, absolutely. I mean, there's things that you can do and enable that would be done with CSB, like you know, multi-factor off, all those things could be provisioned there along the way. The roadmap that we've got at the moment, probably with these guys down the front over here, is around SharePoint Online. So how do we extend the core platform components, because we have an understanding of all those identities and where they exist, but we're looking at taking that out of Office 365 and moving into more of SharePoint Online. I think there's probably a lot of initiatives, and I think it's probably understanding how to best engage with them all. You're familiar with that, I'm sure. Yep. Yeah, so there's two parts to it. Obviously there's Azure and then there's Office 365. So with Office 365 we've got, you know, a number of sort of internal development ones that sort of Microsoft own and look after, and then the department has a number of them, but they've got their own test, they've got their own mirrored production environment, and they've got their own production as well. So, you know, and there's three different deployments that are all air-gapped, essentially, and all rely on sort of replica systems within DEET for those identities and things like that. But yeah, there's dev test stuff as well. There's also tenants, I guess, for the Evergreen piece as well. We've just got a tenant that's vanilla Office 365. It's not got CSB, and it's not got any of the address book policies or anything like that configured in it. It's just an off-the-shelf Office 365 where you can see these products first up. I think a lot of along the way, it's quite easy just to get in and get started with a cloud ID and play with something up front, rather than sort of go through the hoops of understanding and sharing identities across like that. So we've got that there for the department as well. Anyone else? All right, guys, thanks for coming. Enjoy the rest of Ignite.